the domestic battles in our political scene, and, you know, right and left and pros and cons and so forth. But historically, and a lot of folk are aware of, that's okay, it's okay. You know, there's been a lot of talk in recent months and years, particularly about Christian nationalism and sort of turning the governing process into a theological dispute of one kind or another, all of which is true in a problem of itself. For a long, long time, foreign policy tended to be seen as, you know, politics stops at the water's edge, and for much of the life of many of us in this room, anyway, foreign policy was kind of defined by the Cold War. And there was no question that there was the good guys, the bad guys. Now, Vietnam kind of complicated that discussion, of course, but fundamentally we kind of saw it as, you know, the forces of truth, justice, and the American way, you know, a la Superman, were out there struggling against the forces of evil and communism and so forth. And I think that is still a very strong mindset in the American population, even though it's us boomers who lived with that and are now in the process of slowly disappearing over the horizon. But it still, I think, is a very strong shaping factor in much of what's going on. And I think you see it very much today in Ukraine and China. It's, you know, we like having an enemy. It makes things simple, black and white. Bipolar, binary, bilateral are the way we do things. And life, you know, is actually far more complicated than that. Most of us understand in our own lives, but that's not the way we think in political and foreign policy terms. And then, of course, we got 9/11. And that got everybody back very much into a good guys, bad guys, evil terrorists, and good other people. The problem is, I put those other people, us, because some of the people on our side are actually not very nice people. Kind of goes back to some parts of it, I guess, too. So what I wanted to do today is, first, I'm going to talk a little bit about Libya, of all places, which may not be on the top of everyone's list, but I think it's an interesting example story of how certain assumptions about who is doing good things and how the law of unintended consequences sort of takes the root, and the fact that we have a very hard time in the United States being patient, or you could say sticking with the problem. We have at least a chronic case of attention deficit disorder, and we move from one issue to the next quite quickly. Now, here's just a, you know, obvious simple map of North Africa. We'll get to some parts of this in a minute, but we all know, of course, Egypt and Israel and Jordan over there. Then you've got, there's Libya. Libya is not as big as Algeria, but it is a very big country. Most of us have no grasp of how large Africa is, and it's just massive. I mean, many of these countries are twice the size of Texas, and the continent has 55 countries. Few of them are tiny, yes, but most of them are actually quite large. So Libya is, in many respects, a collection of tribes. It is not what most of us would think of as kind of a modern nation state. And like sort of all of those countries across that northern tier, actually, I mean, Morocco is an absolute monarchy with a little bit of tree trimming to make it look less than an absolute monarchy, but it still is. Algeria, of course, you may recall, fought a long and very bloody civil war against the French, who finally pulled out. And then there was another long and bloody civil war internally that led to now a military leadership that has been there for at least 25 years, if not longer. Egypt, of course, had Sadat in it for a long time, and then, you know, he moves, and then they had other people, and now again, once again, a military leader in Mohamed Sisi. Libya, we all know from Muammar Gaddafi. I'll probably know that name, remember it. And he was a real, you know, challenge and problem. Libya basically lives off of oil and gas. It's not got a lot else, but it does have good old fossil fuels, which up until recently, we all thought was pretty important, people wanted access to. And that's really where the money was. And it was led by this, not, he wasn't really a Muslim. He was a Muslim by definition, but not really, he was not leading an Islamic state. He was just leading a personally led state run by his people and his family. And Libya was up to no good at various points, most famously the Lockerbie bombing. That took a plane down over Scotland, which was carried out by Libyan special forces. So Libya was on our bad list for a very long time. Then after 9/11, after 2001, and then after we invaded Afghanistan that year, and then Iraq in 2003, Gaddafi decided that maybe he was next, and thought he should do something to stop that. And so he very, in actually a very rational, sensible fashion, decided he needed to make peace with the West. And he handed over the perpetrator of Lockerbie bombing to the West for justice. And he handed over all of his nuclear weapons materials, because they had a nuclear weapons plan. And we, the British in particular, and other Western European countries, thought this was a wonderful idea, of course, and we promised that in exchange, we would ensure that there was good investment and business operations funneled into Libya, so that it could get back on its feet in a more modern economy. Well, because we have a short attention span, and because we then got hit by the financial crisis, 2007, 2008, 2009, that period, we basically decided Libya, just really wasn't worth paying a lot of attention to, which is the way we generally treat almost all of Africa and North Africa too, even though I know there's plenty of differences there, but we really just don't pay much attention to that entire region. And since we hadn't paid attention to Libya for a long time, we really had very few people who knew anything about it. And so they didn't have much of a voice in Washington. And we were having fun domestically, our oil producers, with fracking. And so fracking was reducing our need to import. So Libya became of ever less importance. And starting about 2008-9, Gaddafi started saying, why aren't you doing what you promised us you would do? Spend money and invest and help us out. And because partly there was partly because of his rigid form of governance, and partly because the economy kept not working very well and wasn't getting much aid and wasn't getting the investment it had been promised, there was a lot of public unhappiness, public dissent. And then in 2011, we begin what's called the Arab Spring. Remember, it starts in Tunisia with a market seller who finally had it and doused himself with kerosene and burned himself to death, and sort of the entire Middle East went up in flames, including the. And at that point, there was an uprising.
Whoops.
There was an uprising on this side of the Benghazi side. And Gaddafi over here started threatening that he was going to bomb those people into submission. And the French, in particular, who are the historic colonial power here, and the British, but particularly the French, started saying, we need to do something about this. We've got to stop it. And this was done under the rubric of responsibility to protect. Now, that sounds like a good thing. Who doesn't want to protect? The responsibility to protect, which is a international relations doctrine that had been developed through the UN systems and had been approved as an official UN doctrine. And what it was meant to respond to was things like the Rwanda genocide of 1996. It was sort of, we need an international mutual understanding that you can't just say whatever happens inside a country stays there. That if it's bad enough, there is a justification for intervening. Now, brief aside, the problem with that is that that's the theory we used for invading Iraq, for example, even though it turns out our intelligence was entirely wrong, or even manufactured. So responsibility to protect, and many of us, some of us, believe this from its beginning, was an excuse for major powers to intervene when they wanted to. But it really wasn't going to solve anything very much. And it was going to be, in fact, like all these things, it was going to have a worse downside when it got misused. But at this point, 2011, it was still at least justifiable to say, we should do this and stop Gaddafi from slaughtering. We asserted. It's not clear he really meant to do that. But in any case, we said, you can't do this. We have to go in and stop this. Well, somewhat has happened in Afghanistan, where we went in to take out Al-Qaeda. And then we decided, well, since we're here, why don't we fix Afghanistan? So we'll take out their government and put a new one in, and everybody will be happy. But we all know how long, well, that worked 20 years later. Well, we did roughly the same thing here. Now, when this happened, and I will claim, not that I was alone, because many of us saw this, but I will claim a little prescience. I said, if you've got basically one coastal road here from Tripoli to Benghazi, and Gaddafi was going to move tanks. Well, tanks need flat surfaces, basically. So I said, all we really need to do is bomb the road, crater the road with appropriate munitions, and the tanks are not going to be able to get there, and we can stop this. But those were older and wiser than I said, no, we're going to take out the government. So they took out Gaddafi, or ended up taking out Gaddafi after we'd gone in. That's another slide.
Yeah, which one do you want?
Well, drop down one. And
mouse on.
Sorry, yeah. What's next? There we go. That's just basic Libya. Here's the Benghazi side. And let's go back up one. Yeah, the Benghazi side there, the Tripoli side here. Here's your coastal road. And instead of just sort of making it impossible to move from side to side, there we go. One more. One less, I guess. There we are. So instead of just taking out the coastal road, we decided we should take out the government and replace it. Well, what happened? Gaddafi had kept himself in power largely through employing mercenaries, thousands of them, and had major weapons supplies, munitions supplies, lots of nothing, you know, super fancy. But so we're not talking maybe tanks and certainly not very many airplanes, but plenty of AK-47 type weapons, a fair amount of artillery, and lots of weapons for all of those. And he employed hundreds, thousands of mercenaries. And when the government collapsed, mercenaries work for you as long as they get paid. When the pay stops, the mercenaries go look for other things to do. And that's kind of what's happened. Come down another one. Yeah, I got to remember where these slides are. Okay, so I grabbed this from something showed up the other day. In 2011, NATO bombed Libya with the aim of preventing a massacre that they said was bound to happen, responsibility to protect. No massacre happened then, but NATO's intervention led to the collapse of the government, the murder of its ruler, civil war, the death of thousands, the displacement of many more to the shores of Europe and elsewhere, where their existence, inter alia, fomented a populist revolt that is yet to subside. Libya still lacks a viable central government. Got another. Okay. The people who left Libya are the core of why we have had four coups in Central Africa in the last year. Because, again, they want to be paid, so they go looking for somebody who will pay them. And there are Al-Qaeda Islamist organizations there. And even terrorist organizations need a cash flow. So they get a hold of what resources may be in that region. And despite the fact that you and I would say there's nothing there, in fact, there is. There are mineral resources. There are even sometimes food resources available locally. They're not part of the international market, but they serve the region. We, among other countries, keep feeding money to these militaries because we want them to fight terrorism. But we, you know, how well money leaks out of, you know, systems and goes over to other people. So Niger, the place, most recent coup in this area, there's another coup in Gabon down here after this. But Niger is where we have had over 1,000 American troops, a drone base for attacking terrorist cells and units in this entire region. We have been giving the military their money and training them. That buys us the permission to have our base there. And as we really have discovered everywhere we have done this, when you train a country's military, what you make them competent to do is topple the government. You give them enough organization and skill and weapons that they can then take over running the country. And who wouldn't do that? You know, it's much more fun to run a country than to take orders from somebody. You know, basic human nature. It's more fun to be king. So that's what happens routinely, and that's what's happened all through this area, and it's all basically a product of what happened in 2011. And what happened in 2011 is at least in part a product of our failure to do what we promised we would do in 2011, or in 2003, when we got them to handle. Now, another slide. Okay, then we're working on, Libya really isn't functional as a country. It's got two sides, that Tripoli side and the Benghazi side. And both by geography and by tribal linkages and, you know, history, that it's not a terribly well unified country. And there's two major leaders now that are one on each side. And they're, you know, some of them are being supported by Saudi Arabia and some by Turkey. And there's an international, one of them's internationally recognized, which is worth, you know, that and $5 will get you a Starbucks latte, you know. But there is a government, and we are trying to encourage all the governments in that area. You know, Saudi Arabia is a big topic, but we're also trying to get Libya to recognize Israel. So the official foreign minister of Libya met with the real foreign minister of Israel about 3 weeks ago by now. And Libyans did not like this. So you ended up with violent riots in the streets, and the foreign minister had to get on a plane and leave the country. You know, when you have to leave your country as the foreign minister, you know you're in trouble. So Libya is unstable. We're in there trying to accomplish our political objectives with a government that is not capable of running, you know, running its own living room, let alone a real country. And then we get a storm and floods. Part of the point that fellow actually had that slide up earlier is making in what he goes on to say is, you know, NATO basically took this country apart in 2011 and is now doing absolutely nothing to try and do anything for this country. The dams, had there been a functioning government, the dams likely would not have broken. You know, even weak governments know that they have to deal with some of those things, or putting it differently, outside aid money would have done something to make sure that those dams were at least adequately shored up, because you want to avoid humanitarian disasters like this. So Libya is sitting there losing people. I mean, people, huge quantities are dying. It's probably worse than Morocco, from what I'm reading. On the one hand, it's not like any of us wanted this to happen, but our failure, our collective, the West's collective moral failure, and certainly America's, is that we didn't pay any attention. We didn't really care. And so we start out with the best of intentions, you know, responsibility to protect. We're going to make sure that this evil dictator doesn't continue running the country. But if you think governments and bureaucracies are, you know, evil or led by the wrong people or what have you, try living in a country that doesn't have one. And that's what we've got, is that kind of a situation with nothing happening there that's useful, huge damage done. The country's still in a civil war, so the likelihood of actually accomplishing much in the near future is slim. And we're putting our time and energy into Ukraine and really couldn't terribly much care less about, you know, what's going on in Libya. What's next? There. Cluster bombs. And what I'm going through here is sort of a list of things that the rest of the world is paying attention to, and we're not much. And then we wonder why we don't get much support in various places and situations. Convention on Cluster Munitions prohibits the use and production of cluster weapons. Did I put a picture in next? Yeah, shows that. That's what a cluster weapon looks like. So you've got all these little bomblets. And, you know, we used these back in Vietnam era. And people are still, you know, digging them up and dying or losing limbs often, particularly in Cambodia and Laos, where we use them extensively. I think Vietnam to a degree, but the perverse reasons, really more out there that. So now, why did we send cluster munitions? Yeah.
Can you just give a reference as to the size of that?
The bomblets are about the size of baseballs.
Okay. So that's about 5 feet long.
Probably. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Why are we sending cluster munitions? Anybody catch this in the PR of the administration?
Well, didn't Ukraine request it?
No. They requested 155 millimeter howitzer shells. Standard, I mean, they blow things up too. But, you know, one shell hits something and blows up and then it's done. I mean, sometimes they don't blow up and you have unexploded ordnance, but generally speaking, it's a single, you know, single weapon for a target. We've run out. And we can't produce them fast enough. The typical, I was reading, and I've heard again a speech on this just this last week, the typical rate of fire, apparently, in Western military planning has been that you might use 50 howitzer shells a day. The Ukrainians and the Russians have been firing them off at a rate of at least 500 a day. So, and we apparently produce or can produce about 2,000, I think it's a month. And if you're going to increase that, you have to build a new plant. You know, these are like, you're building real things. I mean, this is not like software where you just say copy as and you got another one. These are actual physical objects that you have to melt down metal and reshape it and all that kind of stuff. So we cannot, you know, build this stuff fast enough to fund a war that is using up munitions at a pace that the world has actually never seen. It's staggering. Military people are just stunned at the rate in which this stuff is being used up. Side element of this, if you're dealing with howitzers or any large, you know, weapon like that, it's not only munition that's important, but the barrel. And howitzer barrels apparently are only good for about 500 rounds before the heat of firing this stuff out of them starts to deform the metal. Yeah, exactly. It's good, you know, under our thinking of fighting, it's good for a couple of weeks, basically. And nobody ever kind of thought you'd be doing this on an ongoing basis. So it's sort of like, yeah, you fire 50 today and then in a month you do another training round. No, you know, we're just going through them. Now, some of these numbers, I may have or may not have them precise, but by order of magnitude, this is what's going on. So it's not only you got to have munitions, you got to have barrels. And those also have to get produced from real metal and not just, you know, not just aluminum foil. You know, we're talking serious stuff. So we are putting out cluster munitions, which are going to be there for decades. There's just no question about it. There will be a huge swath of Ukraine, which will be functionally unusable and uninhabitable for, you know, probably the lifetime of anybody who's now fighting that war. You know, their children might be able to use that land, but I mean, think, like I said, we're still finding them in Laos and Cambodia and elsewhere that they've been used. So that's, you know, not a good thing. And, you know, again, most of us, this just kind of went by, you know, yeah, Ukraine asked for them. Yes, you're right. I mean, they did in the sense that they wanted weapons. And if you can't give us the 155s, give us these. But, you know, the rest of the world notices this stuff and it just kind of blows right by our eyes at home. What's the next?
The tank.
Yeah. Then we're also sending shells with depleted uranium anti-tank rounds. Now, depleted uranium is supposedly a very low radioactivity level of metal, uranium metal, that happens to have great properties for being hard, so you can ram that into tanks and it will, you know, penetrate, in principle, penetrate tank armor. These are quite controversial. The British and the Americans, we insist that the radioactivity level is so low that it's beneath background radiation level and therefore doesn't make any difference. Most countries in the world say they shouldn't be used at all, that there is radiation coming, and even if it is very low, you're still adding it to whatever people are exposed to, and it's radiation that didn't used to be there. You are adding to the net radiation uptake of whoever is in that region. Scientists and, you know, defense experts will argue this point, but it doesn't win you any friends, I will tell you that, in the international community. The people, and so we've got a situation from strictly a foreign policy point of view, where President Biden and Secretary Blinken and others are running around, particularly Africa and Asia and Latin America, trying to get these countries to support us vis-a-vis Russia in the Ukraine war. And these countries are saying, yeah, and you're sending depleted uranium shells, you're using cluster munitions, et cetera. And meanwhile, you're escaping scot-free. You know, not a single American has died in this. But you're wanting us to do what? You know, we got enough problems at home already. We got earthquakes, we got fires, we got, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, there we go. Oh, yes, here's two good maps. This was the first United UN General Assembly vote condemning the Russian invasion. And, you know, red was nay, yellows were abstentions, and green. You can see the vast bulk really is green. It was 141, I think, in favor, 141 ayes, 5 nays maybe, and a few dozen abstentions. Now, look at the next map. This is the countries actually arming Ukraine. Like nobody, you know, and this is part of France. That's why it's down there. I mean, so it isn't really Latin America. It just kind of makes it look that way. And it's not that these countries think that Russia's doing the right thing at all, but they're tired of being bossed around by the Americans, who are convinced, as America is, because we are God's chosen people. We are convinced that we're doing the right thing, and why aren't you guys on our side? And we, you know, as our leadership today, and all of us as a whole, I mean, you know, we just think that way. You know, we just assume that, you know, most of what we do internationally is good, and why don't people realize how awful the Russians are? The Indian foreign minister said about a year ago, and he was in Europe when he said this, which explains how he formulated it. He said, Europe has to get over thinking that Europe's problems are the world's problems, but the world's problems are not Europe's problems. He's a very sharp guy and a good knack for a line. But, you know, Europe has to get over, and he would have included us too, but he was in Austria when he said it at a conference. But Europe has to get over thinking that Europe's problems are the world's problems. The world's problems are not Europe's problems. And that is kind of become the attitude to us, in us in particular, to the West in general. And we go at this with, as I say, and I think I say this fairly seriously, while I'm talking a lot in general foreign policy terms, but we really do have a sense of mission. You know, divine mission as the city on the hill, that we're supposed to carry out diplomacy or democracy to the world. And, you know, most of the world, you know, is not really interested in democracy and is really interested in, you know, progress economically and socially and so forth. And we don't really help very much of any of those, because we've spent certainly the last 20 years fixated on counterterrorism, and the sort of the decade before that, we weren't paying any attention to anybody during the 1990s, because we thought, you know, Cold War was over, we won, what is there to worry about? But in fact, you know, that was a time when we could have accomplished a lot domestically and internationally, but, you know, we failed, we chose not to. This is an interesting graph. You divide up the stance on the Russia-Ukraine war by share of global GDP money. You've got 60% of the country condemns Russia for the war based on how much money they got. 60% of global GDP condemns Russia. 15% of the global population condemns Russia. So we tend to forget how small we are. In the West, all Western Europe and the United States and Canada, and then you can probably add in Australia and New Zealand and such to boot, and you're still, even if you include Japan, which isn't Western, I realize, but it's a modern, you know, modern capitalist democracy, you're up to maybe 15% of the globe. We're only about 4%, 5%. So the vast bulk of the global population just isn't interested in what we're interested in. And while we've got the money and the guns, broadly speaking, they're not doing as bad as they used to be. And so, you know, India, China, and even countries like Turkey and others are feeling their oats and are sort of tired of taking guidance from us and the West in general. Most of the world is more upset about the impact of the Ukraine war and tangentially the China thing on their problems, food and energy prices, currency shifts, etc., than the war itself, which they see as an anti-Western struggle, which shouldn't be their problem. Trade groupings in Africa, Asia, and South America are at work at increasing trade without regard to U.S. interests. So, you know, sort of our assumption that everybody's, you know, ultimately on our side just doesn't wash. And partly it's because of what we've done. Partly it's because every country's looking after their own interests. Why would they look after some other country's interests? You know, I'm not trying to advocate greed or egocentrism, but that's the basic human condition. You know, you take care of yourself and your family, and your nation first. Then you worry about what you can do, you know, with somebody else. You know, more people live here than in the entire rest of the globe put together. And you notice that doesn't even include any of Africa or the Middle East or Latin America, let alone the West. We commonly understand them. More of just how we don't get a lot of. This came from the Norwegian Refugee Committee, and I thought it was just a fine slogan in one of their reports just recently, a couple months back. But, you know, neglect is a choice. You know, people, you know, are in the situation they are in Libya, in Morocco, in Pine Ridge, in South Dakota. You name it, by choice. Somebody's making decisions to neglect. These problems are all addressable. Now, there's only like 5 million Norwegians, so they can't do it all themselves, obviously. But, you know, millions of displaced people endure exceptional hardship, overlooked and cast aside by those in power and with the resources to bring a brighter future. The suffering is not inevitable, as the urgency and scale of the response to the war in Ukraine has demonstrated. When the West cares, it can do stuff. But you can see what we care about and what we don't care about, which gets into a whole other issue. And this is partly summarized, if you will, not entirely, but we hear a lot about shared values. And we want to keep pretending that countries share values with us, except when we need them, in which case, then we're satisfied to share interests instead. But right now we've got a problem, for example, where South Africa or Saudi Arabia's values are not exactly ours. And the problem is becoming that their interests aren't either. I mean, they're not selling their oil to the West. They're selling most of it east. We have not bought much Saudi oil to speak of for almost a decade. You know, they are not beholden to us for a market. And they are now buying Russian oil that is shipped to India refined into gasoline, then brought back by, bought by the Saudis for them to sell domestically as gasoline so that they can keep exporting their oil. So there's, and we are actually buying some Saudi gas also, which is ultimately Russian gas or gasoline, but we don't even know that. So this is in the field, I guess, the Libya situation was kind of in the area of, I guess, sins of omission. I mean, we tried to start out with a good idea, responsibility to protect, get Libya to get rid of its nuclear program, et cetera, join the civilized world, and we just did it badly. But I think the other thing that's really worth thinking about is this shoot. And the question of proxy wars and the moral weight of those. Stephen Kinzer is a journalist and historian who writes for the Boston Globe, mostly. He's actually, I think, retired now. We'll still see his columns show up. And he's written a number of histories, history books on sort of American history, particularly in some of its international dimensions. But I thought this, you know, raised the real problem that we're seeing, particularly now in Ukraine, but it's not unique to that, and he goes down through a long list. But, you know, waging war is dangerous. So it's great if someone else will do it for you. And that's what makes proxy wars. Western leaders are pouring weaponry into Ukraine, mainly because Ukraine is wounding Russia, our geopolitical rival. Facing a common enemy, we make a grim bargain. US and Europe provide money and weapons, while Ukraine provides the soldiers who fight and die. This deal is part of every proxy war. And, you know, Mark Warner, Senator from Virginia, Hillary Clinton's running mate in 16, fine human being, generally speaking. The Ukrainian army is being chewed up by the Ukrainians. We're having the Ukrainians do that right now, in a sense, for us. I find that, you know, just kind of morally unacceptable, if not reprehensible. But that's what we're seeing. And he goes through how Saudi Arabia has been doing this in Yemen with our weapons and intelligence, and goes on to a number of other examples. And then ends, you know, proxy wars will rage until big powers tire of them. In the meantime, blood will drench those countries' soil, and their sons and daughters will continue dying. And that's the piece of the discussion on Ukraine that I just don't see anyone discussing in this country, with partial exceptions like Kinzer. And the fact that we will not address that issue clearly, I find a problem, a moral and ethical problem, and therefore a problem for Christians, that we're tolerating this, saying, well, but the Russians are so bad. Rather than saying, how do we stop killing? Stop people killing each other. So, what do you think?
We only scratched the surface.
Yeah?
And we only scratched the surface.
Sure. Take a little deeper, Bonnie. You...
So. Well, I mean, we have global issues in Latin America,
yeah.
It goes deeper in Africa, and we didn't really talk about the dynamics with China.
No, there's so many, but I wanted to take a couple that were a little off the main field, at least for starters.
But one comment, I couldn't believe how little reaction there was about the cluster bombs, mm-hmm. because we were appalled when other nations used them.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And that's part of the problem. Exactly. And why, you know, it may go over the head of most Americans who aren't paying that much attention, but the rest of the world notices. You know, we may not, but they do. Yeah.
Well, it's very depressing, and I hadn't thought much about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Brought up, especially about Libya, I wasn't.
Yeah, who knows
much? Yeah, because it's not talked about much.
No.
Maybe if I read my economist more thoroughly, I would know.
You pick up a little bit.
But then what about all the politicians here that say, we shouldn't back Ukraine.
Yeah.
And that's what comes to my mind.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Complicated question, obviously, you know, what do we do?
Don't ask them if that is.
Yeah, you're something I didn't.
I think it's the word plugs in.
Yeah.
And so it's the clothing.
I shouldn't have picked my place up.
See, it's in here somewhere. There we go.
Okay, I'll hold it.
Yeah.
So anybody got other thoughts on how we ought to look at these problems or why it's so hard to recognize that these are multi-sided?
I think there's a big problem with people not informing themselves and relying on media. And I think media does a really poor job of reporting or discussing a lot of the complicated issues.
Yeah.
I actually spoke personally yesterday to someone who had never heard that in the January 6th insurrection, the crowd was chanting, "Hang Mike Pence."
They didn't hear that?
They did not know that that had occurred. And I'm like, what planet are you on?
Haven't you watched? I mean, it was on the news. It was there.
I rest the case. I rest the case.
Yeah. No, good point.
Is that, and was that a younger generation person?
No, it was old.
Really?
Like me, my age.
Really?
People who still watch television.
Because I'm not sure where the younger generation is getting their news. That's.
Good question.
Listen to it.
Neither of my daughters or daughters watch the news.
Yeah.
And they don't read the newspaper.
I mean, my daughter and son-in-law in Washington, D.C., who work for the government, don't take a newspaper. They read it online. They get stuff online, but, and then they're pretty well informed, I expect to say. But, you know, I can't imagine what you do in Washington, D.C. without reading a couple of daily newspapers. I don't get it.
I think some of it is everybody says everything's so depressing, I'm better off not listening to anything.
Yeah, I'm depressed today.
The decision making tends to, I think, among other things, it happens in relatively narrow circles. And the rest of us sort of have given up to a large degree and, you know, can we influence this in any way? And I think, again, one quick sec, Marty. Domestically, we have some of the same problems, but we often, those problems are closer to us. So we may get worried about the police in our town or the school issue or the taxation or the dam that needs to be fixed. You get into international stuff and that's further away and it quickly becomes very simplistic, you know, good guys, bad guys, et cetera. Do any of you get Heather Cox Richardson's?
Yeah.
She is great, I think, on U.S. history and domestic politics. When she strays over to foreign policy, she is channeling the Beltway standard information. There's no critique, there's no analysis behind the scenes as she does for American stuff. It's sort of like, you know, Dr. Richardson, stick to your area of expertise. He says, every time I see her moving into that field, I could just as well be reading it on the editorial page of the Washington Post, which I don't consider to be a great source of, you know, actual good analysis. I mean, they're both feed in on the war. We got to be there as long as possible and no attention to the fact that Ukrainians are dying and we're not. And what might we think about that? She's great domestically, but overseas, she falls into just the standard, you know, politics in the water's edge in America only as a force for good in the world, which is just sort of demonstrably untrue. And she's smart enough to know that, which is what makes it so frustrating. She's not right wing, you know, act. She's a thoughtful person. So why is she so shallow on her international stuff? Margie, do you want to?
As your excellent sermon today, or message to us,
This is a problem all the way to America.
Yeah, true.
And if this part of our DNA.
Yeah.
I hate to think of it that way.
Yeah.
Being a genealogist, I have to think of DNA containing even one little microcosm of this. But if this is how we think.
Yeah, this is why we have prayer and confession every Sunday in church.
And we are so, if it's even so difficult today for, okay, I'm just going to say for a Democrat to even believe that the Republican even had one shred of credibility to them.
Right, and vice versa.
Regardless of where they stand on any issue.
Yeah.
If they've got the label Republican, they're automatically out of my circle.
Sure, yeah.
If all of these are out, you can understand why it is so difficult.
Yeah.
All of these problems are so difficult.
No, very true.
And to be bigger than, to be bigger to understand the injustice and so much of this isn't anything that you can really teach people. They have to see it by example.
Yeah.
And if we're not seeing enough examples of this, I don't think there can be answers.
Yeah, no, it is very difficult. Yeah, part of what troubles me at a theological level about our foreign policy, you know, often people will say America is a Puritan nation or a Calvinist nation, but they don't understand Calvinism, for one thing, because part of the essence of our tradition, I know Jim Cook may not agree with me on this one, but is the conviction that we all fall short of the glory of God. We all sin and fall short, which means you have to recognize that any decision is a mix of good intentions and self-interest. And in our foreign policy, we generally will not recognize that. We will insist that it's only our good intentions. We will not deal with the fact that it's also part of our self-interest and that we're doing things for access to cheaper oil or cheaper labor, or we're blaming Colombia and other countries for the drugs problem, which is our problem, not their problem. It's a U.S. people who buy that stuff. So blaming the Colombians or the Ecuadorians or something is, you know, kind of crazy. We got to figure out how to deal with our problem and then talk maybe because they've got a problem too, but not one that we're fixing for them with herbicides and guns. But, you know, good Presbyterian theology says, you know, we are fallen beings and we have to recognize that in order to then, you know, seek to follow more closely the one who created us. But on our foreign policy, despite our claims of a Christian nation, it's all very simplistic. It's we're the good guys and they're the bad guys. And that's just not a way to run a railroad. Yeah.
You mentioned Heather Cox Richardson.
Yeah.
You have a similar kind of accessible person who's writing that you follow or feel is doing a good job
of
foreign policy broad-based information on a regular basis.
Yeah. Some of the best people I read is the Tim Cert is very good. And some of this stuff you can just Google and come up with some of it paywall Boston Globe, which gets frustrating. I find in general, I don't agree with totally, but Fareed Zakaria, who writes for the Washington Post and does a program on CNN every weekend, he's a
Sunday morning
Pakistani
church.
Okay, yeah, in some places, but it's at other times. They play it more than once because they're filling up airtime on Sundays. It was Fareed Zakaria, Zakaria. He's, I think, Pakistani origin, probably. American citizen, been here for a long time. But he brings that international view on problems.
That's good to know.
So I find him worth reading. I don't always agree with him, but he is, I think, the best people. I mean, Kinzer is an American, but he's done enough international reporting to bring a different viewpoint. Zakaria is good. There's a couple of people who writes the Financial Times that I like to read because, again, they're bringing a foreigner's viewpoint to our problems. The problem is the FT is paywalled and it's hard to get into. there's a surprising number of South Asians that are really good writers on the West. There's a guy named Janan Ganesh, J-A-N-A-N Ganesh, G-A-N-E-S-H, who's good on stuff. And then there's a fellow named Pankaj Mishra, P-A-N-K-A-J. The last name is M-I-S-H-R-A. I can't remember if there's a J at the end of that or not.
Sure, all those with Sheila.
No, sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think in general, I find it almost the best thing to do is look for non-Americans.
Non-Americans.
Not that there aren't smart people here, obviously.
Sure, sure.
There are. But we're all so close to our situation that we just don't see it from that other perspective.
Okay.
And that to me is what really pays off in international travel, in sending students abroad, learning another language, and learning how other people look at things. Yeah. That's supposedly what diplomacy is all about, is understanding other countries. Yes, you still want your way, but you want to do it in a way that, you know, somebody's definition of diplomacy is, you know, convincing other people that your way is better for them too, as distinguished from beating them over the head and saying, we won't give you any aid unless you do it our way, which may get you a vote in the UN, but it doesn't win you any friends. What are we getting into here? About a couple of minutes. We're scared everybody else off. Or we can stop.
Do you not see Russia taking over adjoining countries as a as large a threat as it has been?
I really don't. Not, and that's not to say that Russia wouldn't love to have the buffer that it used to have in the Soviet Union. But I think they clearly, I mean, they've done, Putin made a profound error, massive, that has done, you know, a generation's worth of damage to Russia. And I think, you know, they're stuck where they are. They're not going to get any further. And the current line of fight is as far west as Russia is going to get in Ukraine. But the longer we fight that war, everybody who's involved, it's like World War I in 2017. You know, it should have been done then, if not earlier, and yet people kept dying for another year in large quantities before the war finally was brought, you know, to an end in 1918. And it seems to me that's why do we want Ukraine to be as damaged as Russia is. And then, yes, it's going to require an armistice line and ongoing, you know, reinforcement of that line. But it's also going to require peace treaties and arms control treaties like we used to have. In the 1990s, 2000s, we had arms control treaties with the Soviet Union and then Russia, which put structures around what was happening there. We really encouraged the Ukrainian uprising in 2014. We may or may not have actually created it, but we certainly were happy with it and we helped it along. And from 2014 on, we actively trained their military, which was a great thing in terms of the Ukrainian military's ability to withstand the first Russian attack. But it also encouraged the Russians to believe that we really were setting up Ukraine to be the forward line moving up against Russia. And then on November 10th of 2021, November 10th, we signed a joint agreement on military cooperation with Ukraine, promising them military training and the purchase of and acquisition of American weaponry. And when did Putin invade? 3 months later. And if we're signing agreements for military assistance to a country that the other country sees its neutrality as essential to their well-being, we're inviting a problem. Now, Putin's the one who pulled the trigger and, you know, deserves all the blame for the damage that's been done. But it's not like there wasn't a history. And we were aggressively pushing, since 1996, a policy of getting closer and closer and closer to the Russian border, despite our own people saying this is going to end in tears. Now, Bill Burns, the current head of the CIA, wrote a cable in 2008 when we were encouraging the invitation to Georgia and Ukraine. And he wrote a cable back to Washington saying, this will be unacceptable. This crosses a red line. This will never be tolerated by Moscow. And it wasn't. And we have known this for decades. Since I was in Moscow in 92, we've known that the expansion of NATO to the edge of Russia would be unacceptable to Russia. But we're God's gift to democracy and progress. So we don't, you know, rules, what's the old Helmsley line? Taxes are for little people. You know, rules are for little people, you know, for little countries. Great powers dictate, great powers make their own reality. Well, we made our own reality, except it's the Ukrainians who get the down. Okay. Pat, do you have something? Okay.
How is our difference in our involvement different than when Poland and Lubinsky, whatever we might call the house? How are we different this time with Ukraine and when we were in Poland have their revolution?
Well, the Polish one, of course, never led to fight. And Ukraine was part of the Russian Empire. Poland was not. Pieces of it, I mean, the borders have changed there a lot over the centuries. But you'll notice no one ever says, let's get Ukraine back to its historic borders, because there aren't any. There's no identifiable historic Ukraine. What we're dealing with here, this was interesting, it came up the other night at a meeting of that. There's sort of, this is not, some people want to say this is simply a classic interstate, two countries, Westphalian principles, you know, non-intervention in the sovereign affairs of another nation. So Russia's wrong, which it is, but that under Westphalian rules, yes, of course. Then you've got the civil war. You know, this is just the Slavic peoples fighting civil war, which it kind of is, sadly, and civil wars are nastier by far than interstate wars. But what this is a post-imperial war. Ukraine does have a level of ethnic identity, but that is, you know, identifiable, separate from Russians. But one, the two populations overlap profoundly. Two, Ukraine has essentially zero history as a nation. There was a Ukraine back in the 1600s for about 5 years, and that was it. So it's part of Russian imperial identity in a way that Poland is not, for example. And so, you know, for Russia and physically, this is the Great Plain. This is where Napoleon marched in. This is where the Nazis marched in. And so the thought that Ukraine is not safe for Russia is just unacceptable. It's a lot like, actually, it's like the situation between Pakistan and Afghanistan that gave us such fits. From Pakistan's point of view, Afghanistan has to be a safe backyard. Because India's its front, as far as it's concerned, and India's the enemy. So its backyard has to be reliable and safe. And we went in there and installed a government that was not overtly pro-Pakistani. And so Pakistan never was going to accept that. So we kept complaining, you're giving aid and comfort to the people we're fighting in Afghanistan. And they'd say, oh, no, we're not, let's work. But the reason they were was because it was of existential significance to them in their head, anyway, or not, but it may or may not be true, but for them, it was absolutely obligatory that Afghanistan be a government that would work constructively with them. And Russia's got the same attitude towards Ukraine. That doesn't make it justified or right, but if you don't understand that, how are you going to structure a situation, a set of arms control treaties, etc., that will say, we want everybody to feel safe and we don't want people fighting each other. So you got to understand how they actually approach this. Instead of simply saying, we have played NATO expansion like it's a risk game. You know, you're shaking your dice for how many people you get to move where on the board. But we're dealing with people and what's between their ears. And we may not agree with it, but that's what they're going to do. And so we've got how many hundred thousands of different, because we were playing risk instead of dealing with real people. In my view. So, now, empower it all you can. Thank you.
Yeah, it's cool.